Hello and welcome to See You in Court, a podcast that informs you about the Georgia civil justice system, what it means to you, and how it protects individual rights. During each episode, we dive deep into stories, cases, and insights that matter to Georgians. You can learn more on our website at www.seeyouincourtpodcast.org. Join the conversation on our YouTube channel at See You in Court Podcast, and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/seeyouincourtpodcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation. Your hosts are Robin Fraser Clark and Lester Tate, who are both past presidents of the State Bar of Georgia and who both serve on the board of directors of the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation. And now this episode of See You in Court.
Good morning, friends and lovers of the law, and welcome to See You in Court. I am Robin Fraser Clark, and with us here today is our esteemed co-host, Lester Tate. Hey, Lester. Good afternoon.
How are you, Robin? It's another Friday that we're recording on, and I'm always happy on Friday. And plus, I think you and I are getting ready to have an excursion to Laguna Beach, California, with our meeting at the International Society of Barristers. So I'm excited about that as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I hope the weather will be good. And it's a week of enrichment, not necessarily law related, which I really enjoy. And Bill and I are going to play a little golf. So
I hadn't planned on taking my golf clubs. I didn't sign up for it because it's such a hassle.
I know, but we're taking ours.
But yeah. You can always rent them out there.
Right.
You know, I can't throw those rental clubs when I make a bad shot like I can my own, you know, so.
Well, we'll have a lot of fun out there, and maybe our next recording, we'll report back to our listeners how it was.
That'd be great.
Well, today we're excited to have as our guest, McCracken Poston Jr., a Georgia trial lawyer, one of my favorite types of people. And he's a new author, and we're going to talk about his compelling new book, Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. What a great title that is, by the way.
It is.
Let me introduce McCracken to our listeners. McCracken Poston Jr. is a Georgia trial lawyer practicing criminal defense in Ringgold, Georgia. He is a former four-term legislator in the Georgia House of Representatives. He is a graduate of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga and is a 1985 graduate of the University of Georgia School of Law. He has practiced law for 39 years in Georgia. He gained national attention for his handling of several notable cases that were featured on CNN Presents, Dateline NBC, A&E's American Justice, and Forensic Files. His new book, Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom, tells the tale of Alvin Ridley, accused of murdering his wife, and McCracken's courtroom battle for justice for Alvin. Wow. McCracken, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Well, and I gotta jump in and say that I think I've known Ken longer than any of my contemporaries in the Georgia bar, because when he was in law school, it was before I went to law school, we both worked for Congressman George Buddy Darden in Washington, D.C., which is that's where we first met.
That's right. Those were great days.
Well, yeah. Working for George Buddy Darden is a pretty darn good pedigree, if you ask me.
It is. No and we both retired from politics to invest our further energies in trials and courtrooms. So
you retired. I got fired.
I guess that's true. You know, Buddy was the DA of Cobb County when he was 28. He said he was the youngest DA in Georgia. And he said 4 years later, I was the youngest ex-DA in Georgia. So,
I was in Athens, Georgia, and I don't know how he got my number there, but maybe I'd given it to him. But Norman Underwood called me. Mm-hmm. And this was just after the Soviets had shot down our congressman over Sakhalin Island in the Northwest Pacific. And I did not know Buddy. But Norman Underwood suggested that I get to know Buddy, and that he had suggested Buddy to talk to me about some of the northern extreme counties. And I mean that only in geography then. So I got to know Buddy that way, as he was running, and against him was the congressman's widow. Do you remember?
I do.
Lester.
I do.
So I lucked out after helping Buddy with an internship, during law school internship, one of the best, you know, experiences I ever had. I highly encourage my son to try to work in Washington a bit.
Yeah. One thing I remember, I worked for Senator Nunn before that. And I remember when they were covering the race in the Washington Post, they went to Kerry's hamburger joint down right across from Dobbins Air Force Base and interviewed people about whether they preferred the widow McDonnell or soon to be Congressman Darden. And one of the patrons in there, and this is one of those quotes you can never forget. They asked him how he felt about the widow running. And he said, well, you know, it just don't seem right to me. He said, the fish ain't even eating him yet, and she's out there running for Congress. And that's a quote from the Washington Post, you know, so don't write me any letters about it. I'm just relating what they said, you know.
Well, I was only 4 years out from running myself for state house. And so I was very much into it, but Buddy taught us both a lot. And one of my favorite Buddy Darden stories is the lady from Marietta that called him, wanted to complain about her garbage not being picked up. And Buddy in Washington said, well, ma'am, that really is an issue for like your mayor and city council of Marietta. And she said, well, I didn't want to bother them with that.
I love it.
Those are great stories.
My book begins on the night that a congressman named Nathan Deal destroyed mm-hmm. my hopes of going to Congress. Yeah, and that's where my book begins. And
we're familiar with Nathan Deal.
Yeah, I thought so. And yeah. To be completely fair, though, Nathan pops up again in the book. And it was really interesting. He was actually a great motivator for me to continue working with the very difficult Alvin Ridley. Now,
That's interesting. Now, I didn't know he was Governor Deal was a motivating factor for you to continue to work with Alvin, but let's talk a little bit about that, because first of all, just congratulations on a fantastic book. I've read it and I just thoroughly enjoy it. I'm handing it off to my husband, Bill. He'll read it next. And I've given you a 5-star review on Goodreads.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. And of course,
Ray Holland told me the other day that it reminded him of the atmosphere you created of To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, I won't stand good for the person making that statement, because we've known Ray, you know, for a long time. But I really did think that was a very high compliment.
High praise.
Well, Ray would never tell me that, because he's my former legislative roommate. So I have to hear it from other people. Writing this book was like therapy for me.
And tell us about that. Why was it?
Well, that surprised some people that I was so personal in the book. Mm-hmm. I deal with issues of alcoholism in my own family. I deal with things that I had not quite worked through myself, but this cauldron of trying to help a difficult client like Alvin Ridley was just driving me crazy. And I was having to examine, well, why was I so uptight? And I realized I am one class A micromanager. I've always been that way. It's probably cost me 2 marriages. It's a constant struggle in my current relationship. And I began to explore, well, why am I like that? Well, I had a wonderful but pitifully alcoholic father. He was a kind man. He was never mean to us or my mother, but he had an alcohol problem. He drank to excess and was just sad when he drank. And even as a child, you try to figure out what you did to make your father want to check out like that. You don't realize this is a chemical addiction, because it seemed quite voluntary, and you don't want to, you just constantly kind of blame yourself. And in that sense, you try to keep waters calm because you don't want anything pushing him over the edge in that direction. You think maybe if I, am very quiet and I keep calm and I don't ask too many questions, maybe he won't drink. Those are the kind of things that started popping up in my head as I was pouring all this out on a computer screen. My contract, I sold to Kensington under the Citadel imprint for a 90,000 word book. And by the time I got through like what they call a vomit draft, just putting it all out there, I had 177,000 words. And so I hit a mother load of things that just came out of me. And it was really hard cutting it away. And I argued with my copy editors on a lot of it, but I realize now I didn't know a damn thing about publishing, and they know everything about publishing. So I was able to hack enough story away, almost half the story. But I got around, 105,000. I'm still 15,000 words over budget. And I misread the contract about pictures. It said, 16 pages of pictures. Well, I thought a page was a piece of paper, but a page is, both sides of a piece of paper. So I was thinking there's 16 pages loaded up with pictures. So I sent 32 pages worth of pictures in. And they said, oh, no, you got to pick half of that. It's 16 page surfaces. So the wonderful thing is on the electronic version, you got 32 pages of pictures. I found the Chattanooga newspapers were merging literally days before this trial. Sadly, the Chattanooga Times, which is, literally the same owner of the New York Times for years, and I think preceded the New York Times. Adolph Ox started both. They got rid of their photo archive, and that is a historic treasure that they just let get away. Now, the Times Free Press combination papers, I didn't realize it until I was well into writing this book, but their photo archive is in the Chattanooga Hamilton County Public Library. And already a lot of the book was about my father. A lot of the book was about mine and my father's relationship, my father's friendship with Alvin Ridley, and of tolerance and understanding of Alvin Ridley more than anybody else I knew. And I found 247 trial photos in the Chattanooga, Hamilton County, Chattanooga Library, including three photos of my father with Alvin Ridley in the courtroom. And so it was just overwhelming. I thought this, he's supposed to stay in. He's supposed to stay in the story. And so the difficulty, the what makes it a story, and I always love this Maya Angelou quote, that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. This was always such a good story, but I didn't always figure it out. And for years, I would give it to anybody that came along. Jack Warner, the great, late, great Atlanta Constitution reporter. He wrote about the trial. He came up and covered the trial. And one of his stories got picked up and expanded on by the Washington Post front page. So I did make it to Washington, Lester. Front page, and it dog-legged into a big section later on about the trial and about this quirky couple, Alvin and Virginia Ridley. Then People magazine picked it up and did a great piece with beautiful photos by Thomas England. And next thing you know, Forensic Files is doing an episode and American Justice. I was just giving it away. And then a few years ago, and also New Line Cinema optioned a screenplay by Mark Bailey. He is a writer, a screenwriter. His wife is Rory Kennedy, who's the documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So Mark and Rory have met Alvin. They've been to Ringgold. They've met Alvin. And so there are many fits and starts, and I would write, basically the way I preserve the story is I would write anecdotal threads. You know, well, here's the part about the cats. I'm going to preserve that and write that chapter. But I didn't string them all together. Well, then, lo and behold, and I'd given the title Zenith Man to New Line Cinema. Well, they've held it for 5 years and paid us for life rights, but then they just kind of dropped it when they went under and got reconfigured, new administration. And so I just kept putting it off. Life got in the way. Parenthood got in the way. And the next thing you know, someone has written a fictionalized account of our story and called it The Zenith Man. And it drove me crazy that you could do that, but you could do that. You know, it was out there in the public domain, but it really bothered me that the title that I gave New Line and that I reserved literary rights in, that it got used. But there is apparently no copyright in titles. You know, I could have called it the Coca-Cola book or the Bible, I guess you could call it. And, you know, probably get in trouble, but, you know, it would, there is no copyright in titles. So that motivated me. That poor author, I made her admit that it was inspired by true events. It wasn't out of her imagination. But I thank her today because she actually motivated me to get off my ass and write the book. And so I found a wonderful editor to, I said, help me put together a proposal and help me find an agent. And her name is Bonnie Hearn Hill in Fresno, California. She's a writer, but she said, when she looked at my strung together story, she said, I think you can write this. You just need to tell how it changed you.
Well, that brings to question, that brings to mind a sort of question that I want to ask you, Ken. You know, I mean, I think those of us who try cases, and I'm guessing that of the three of us here on the podcast, if we all counted out if we all counted out our trials, not probably jury trials, but if you count everything, you know, we probably got somewhere between 300 and 500 trials, you know, here today. And I've always thought that every trial you have, you leave a little part of yourself in it, you know, when you go through, and you sort of in that process, you lay bare a part of yourself too, maybe that you hadn't realized. But then there's certainly some of them that are sort of watershed events that, And you know, I think all three of us have tried a murder case before. You know, particularly a murder case, it's just one of those things you won't ever forget. And I'm curious if you share that share that view, and if you want to elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I will say this: I'm given hope by the fact that Bobby Lee Cook was 94 and preparing for another murder trial when he died, and was actually studying and preparing for it. And so, you know, I think that gives us a lot of hope that maybe we don't leave too much of ourselves behind, that we don't have something left to give. And Bobby Lee helped me in this case. as I wrote in the book, he was quite a resource to have nearby, and he was very helpful to young lawyers. This case was just difficult because Alvin Ridley was so difficult.
Start us and kind of give us the thumbnail sketch of what happened and how you got involved in it.
Well, everybody knows everybody in Ringgold. Alvin Ridley was a classmate of my oldest sister at Ringgold High School. My family lived up in Graysville, which is above Ringgold and just right at the state line with Tennessee. And so I didn't know all the characters, as people call them, of Ringgold, but I knew of them. And of course, when I later started practicing law, I got to know who they were. But Alvin Ridley was one that was not a pleasant person. He seemed to always be a malcontent. He had a shut down and shuttered Zenith TV repair shop in the middle of town. And although it was shuttered and padlocked, he would post these missives on the inside of the glass facing outward that blamed everybody for all of his ills, including his lost business. I used to go read them discreetly to see if me as state representative made any of the lists ever. And I actually had to confront him one time because this another one of our town characters hitchhiked to the state capitol to have me and Joe Frank Harris address one of his problems. And I was a freshman legislator. And this guy hitchhikes to the capitol. His name was John Howard. And he then disappeared. And I felt totally responsible for this guy. So I became known as the legislator who lost a constituent at the state capitol. I had five agencies looking for this guy. 4:30 the next morning, I get a call. They found John Howard sleeping over in the bushes somewhere. And I came in. And that's the thing about a small town. You're homeless people, and you generally know them by name, and you know something about their backstory. So I knew John Howard's sister. She was with a senior group that came to the Capitol and was planning on seeing her later that session. But I took him to breakfast, and I said, John, why are you here? He said, I got a problem only you and the governor can fix. And I said, well, what is it? He said, I get a check every month, and Alvin Ridley cashes it for me, and he takes 15%. And I said, well, John, go to the bank, get a bank account, and the bank will give you 100% of that money when you cash your check. He said, I knew you and the governor are going to solve this. So I later made the mistake of taking him by to meet Joe Frank Harris and not remembering that Joe Frank Harris knew that I had lost a constituent, and he wanted to engage in some conversation with him. And John Howard said, Ken said you and him was best friends, which I had not said. And it was horrifying. But I came home and I confronted Alvin Ridley about cashing John Howard's check. I said, that's getting close to, you know, that simple act of cashing a check. That's almost usury, you know, getting that much money from him. All I got was a cold, dead stare back at me. And so I was really surprised the night I got beat by Nathan Deal. Alvin was out protecting his building because we had unusual nighttime activity up the block, being my campaign office, and ran into Alvin that night. And I remembered that Alvin had run for sheriff. He got so disgruntled, he ran for sheriff of Catoosa County in 1984, and he got less than 300 votes. Well, I lost the entire old 9th district for Congress, and I lost my county by 300 votes. I was destroyed in the election. So I remember walking by and Alvin saying something to me about getting beat. I remember thinking, I hope my percentages were better than his were in 1984. And so I was really shocked 11 months later when I hear that there is a dead woman in Alvin's house. And then I hear that he said it's his wife. And then the following Monday, for 3 days in a row, I'm seeing him on the same intersection of sidewalk and street. And I realized this is not by chance. This guy's trying to talk to me. So on Wednesday, that first week after Virginia's death, I, you know, said hello and sorry about your loss. And he really just opened up to me. And my first wife got an opportunity to go to Chicago and work and leave in the middle of the congressional race. And I didn't want to interfere with that opportunity for her. And it was, marriage was, as she put it, we didn't have any business getting married. And so we were just going to wait until after the race to file. And so the congressman's staff would know she was never around, and they would kind of torment my staff and say, where did he hide the body? Speaking of me. And so when Alvin started in on how the authorities keep asking him about his wife and this, that, and the other, I just said, I know how you feel. And I was joking for my own benefit. And he really kind of took that to heart. And the next thing you know, my dad gave him my phone number at home. And he's calling me in the middle of the night, screaming, always from a payphone, always out near a highway somewhere. I could not get him to make an appointment. He was paranoid about people knowing where he was. So I finally figured out if I could just say, Alvin, I'll prioritize you because my dad likes you. I'll prioritize you. You don't need an appointment. Just come by on a whim. You can check out, make sure you're not being followed. Just come by and, you know, walk in and I'll take a break from whatever I'm doing if I'm there. And that kind of worked for a while. But things stretched out over time. It appeared, I thought, very possible that he was not going to be charged. 8 months went by. But we had an understanding that if he did get charged, I would come to him. And the last day of June, I believe, of 1998, he got pulled over and arrested after a special grand jury presentment. Now, he was charged with murder and felony murder and aggravated assault, the theory being that he had suffocated or smothered his wife. The state was basing it all on petechial hemorrhaging around her eyes and mouth. There was nothing remarkable about the neck except for where the coroner, ill-advisedly, an assistant coroner, plunged needles into the neck trying to draw blood, creating some artifact after the fact. But the hyoid bone was intact. Alvin was saying consistently, she had a spell. Well, spell meant seizure. Virginia had epilepsy. She also had from childhood, grand mal seizures. I think they call it status epilepticus now. But she also had a situation where she sometimes had allergic reactions to the medications. So Virginia was an interesting character. They married in 1966, 3 weeks after Dolly Parton and Carl Dean came to Ringgold, Georgia to get married. Alvin and Virginia got their marriage license. That was 1966. In 1969, when George Jones and Tammy Wynette came to Ringgold to do their vows, Virginia was already missing. Her parents were putting articles in the local newspapers saying, our married daughter is missing. She's last seen with her husband, Alvin Ridley. So there was a full-on search for Virginia Ridley going on in 1969. The young couple got evicted from public housing in 1970, and Alvin, being as litigious as he always is, he fought it to the point of having a jury trial. Well, Judge Paul Painter tolerated it as much as he could, and then he finally just said, Mr. Ridley, let's get to the bottom of this. Send for your wife. So Alvin's father left the courtroom, went and fetched Virginia. That she came into the courtroom, walked back into chambers with Judge Painter and her parents, and Alvin's dad. They would not let Alvin go back there. And they came out. The judge ended the trial, found for the housing authority to evict them. The theory was that they weren't staying there, so they're violating the terms of their contract. And Alvin and Virginia went and lived with his parents in the house where Alvin lives today. So that was a high water mark for both of them. That was when people interfering in their lives just became so much that Virginia truly never came out again. Now, what's eerie about it is Alvin would not let me in his house. He let any law enforcement that ever wanted in there, but he wouldn't let me. And it was driving me crazy. Now, it was over a year of advising him and then outright representing him.
This is before he's charged?
Yeah, before and during and after he was charged. Would not let me in his house. He would just come up with lame excuses or I'll think about it. The more I pushed, the more excited I got about creating a defense, the more he pushed away. And again, I'm a micromanager and I was probably greatly offending him, ordering him around like that. But I thought somebody's got to take control of this case from him. And so it was extremely difficult. I had nothing in the September term, which was coming up. Thankfully, the case got continued, but not for a full term, only until the first week of January. But I had nothing. And about that time in September, the Olympic track star Florence Griffith Joyner died. She, as it turned out, had a seizure disorder. It was the reason she didn't compete in Atlanta in 1996. And I remember seeing her just as a superstar, you know, non-competing athlete, and just, you know, being disappointed that I wasn't going to be able to see her run because she was, you know, like the greatest. And so I was saddened to hear that she died, but I didn't know yet how she died. So in October, when it comes out that she died of a seizure disorder, that was the epilepsy death that I was looking for. I could not find one because they're somewhat rare now. Bobby Lee's pathology books that he had given me, they gave lots of warnings about not to jump to the conclusion with petechial hemorrhages that it's homicide. They were very clear. The state crime lab doctors' treatises that he, you know, used at school and still carried around in his car also gave that warning. But he was strong in his belief that it was homicide. Now, the coroner, when the body was delivered to the crime lab, she let a little local rumor slip in with the body. She said, and it was reported as fact, the coroner states, this woman has been kept captive in a basement for over 20 years. And so it was an easy stretch if you see, well, if somebody was going to lock somebody up, they very likely killed her.
But you know about that, McCracken, though? I thought if he had been holding her hostage for so long, why didn't he kill her before then?
But plus, that would have also implicated his mother and his father.
I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Who died while there. So it was just so difficult. And Alvin was being unusual and not helping me help him. And it was very frustrating. So as it turned out, I called the Orange County, California pathologist. And I was very careful how I wrote this because I was very careful how I did it. I did not identify myself as a lawyer, but I said, we've got a case here in Catoosa County. And we mean me and Alvin. And we've got this case here and we think it's a case like your track star case. And is there any chance we can get a look at that autopsy? Well, he sent me the autopsy. And it was very much like the condition of Virginia's body. As a matter of fact, if Virginia Ridley was murdered, then Flo-Jo was brutally murdered just because of this more severity of the hemorrhaging. And these are just tiny little spot blood vessels ruptured. And so I had a couple of experts saying that you can get them from a coughing spell. You know, there's a lot of ways you can get petechial hemorrhaging. So our theory was that Virginia had a seizure in the night. Alvin assisted her. And then she went to bed. When he woke up, she had turned to sleep on her face. And I may have had another seizure in that process, or under the theory of sudden death and epilepsy, just something internally caused her to die, but that she had had the seizure before, and that's what created the petechial hemorrhages. So
let me ask you this, McCracken. Tell me what the evidence was that the prosecutor went to trial with. To me, it didn't even seem enough to indict someone, much less make it to a verdict. I just didn't understand. He lived with his wife, and she died in bed, and that's basically it, right?
But fueled with the rumors that he had,
and then
that she hadn't been seen. Her own sisters were pushing the rumors that he was holding her against them. Now, interestingly enough, her parents seemed to be satisfied on that day of September 15, 1970, in the old Catoosa County courtroom, that she wanted to be with her husband. And they backed off. They didn't put any more articles in the newspaper and whatever. But her father died, and her mother went into assisted living, a nursing home. This left her sisters to carry the mantle. And they were young when this was happening back in the 70s, and they just came out strong with the allegation. And the stories became more outlandish as they went. There was thought a rumor that he called a funeral home first, just asking them to come get the body. He did call Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga first, and they told him to call 911, and reluctantly he did. And he had the most flat vocal effect when he called. So it was an accumulation of suspicious mannerisms, which could be explained later, and this legend of him keeping her in the basement, and that being passed on to the state forensic examiner, that it was just the perfect cocktail, the perfect storm of rumor and slight evidence. And so he was charged. Now, they did not charge him with false imprisonment, but they tried to get it in under, you remember the old similar transactions, yes. Nightmare that we used to have to deal with?
Now called 404B, I think.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, they tried to get that in, as well as some other very wild rumored things that, unfortunately, I was worried about the cumulative effect of all of it. I was also worried because Alvin was obsessed with ancient civil litigation, and he made me study it before he would talk to me about the murder case. For one, he started suing people back after his father died, claiming that a relatively minor car accident in 1981 killed his father. His father died of pancreatic cancer, but Alvin had put it together in his head, this Rube Goldberg kind of causation that made him think that this caused all this. So he was always getting slammed in court, getting thrown out, but he was filing his own stuff. He would start off with a lawyer, and then he would fire the lawyer, or they would quit, and he would file his own things. And instead of motions, he called them emotions, which I thought was kind of appropriate. But so there are typed filed emotions in those civil cases.
Presaging internet filing, I guess.
Exactly. So Alvin was just like a gadfly. And And he was so difficult to deal with that I finally was figuring out there was another character, a guy that we called Salesman Sam. I didn't know his real name at the time. But Salesman Sam held himself out to be not only a peddler of cataloged products that he went around on a bicycle selling, but also as Alvin's true legal advisor. And Alvin would go to Salesman Sam, who would almost always advise him 180 degrees differently than I had just advised him, which caused Alvin to bolt the courtroom one day and go to Rome and give him the bum's rush at the federal courthouse and run into Judge Robert Vining's office screaming that his lawyer in Ringgold hadn't knocked his case out yet. Well, the federal marshal said, well, we were worried about him because he seemed to have doused himself in gasoline. And so they thought he was going to like self-immolate or something. Alvin says, well, my car broke down and I got the perfumes of gas on me. And quite frankly, I thought it might have been an improvement because Alvin didn't like to bathe. So, you know, here I was, the nominee of my party for Congress. And 2 years later, I'm dealing with Alvin Ridley. And it was a low. But one day I got a call saying that the congressman wanted to talk to me, my congressman, Nathan Deal. Well, Alvin kind of was with me and he kind of sat up straighter. And I thought, this is odd. I wonder what Nathan Deal wants. I thought maybe he wants to, you know, make up and put me on a committee or something. And then I thought, who am I? This will make Lester laugh. Who the hell am I fooling? I had pissed off both parties and everybody in the whole spectrum. And so I call him. And I'm glad I had the phone to my ear because Nathan Deal said, I'm calling you to tell you to keep Alvin Ridley away from my congressional offices. And Alvin was sitting across from me. And Alvin, who thought he and Virginia both thought that federal government was going to be their salvation. For every ounce of suspicion they had for local and state government, they had pounds of hope for federal government. And that displayed itself many times over throughout the trial. Things Alvin would try, such as running into Judge Vining's office smelling of gasoline. He left for the VA hospital one day when he was supposed to be in court. The state psychologist said he had a paranoid condition, and they introduced me to the term, and I need to know how to pronounce it if I'm going to write it in a book, but it's somatization. It's where you are imagining all of these physical ills, and they really seem true to you. Well, Alvin wanted to wear this really unpleasant, soft neck brace. And it was huge, and it made him look like your classic guy that faked a car wreck, you know, that shows up in court, your worst nightmare when you have a fender bender and that guy shows up for court. Well, Alvin seemed to appreciate that it made him look pitiful. He also had this distorted view of the U.S. Constitution and would tell me, like I should know from law school, that the Constitution says you don't have to go to court if you're not feeling well. And so I had to start carrying a paper copy of the U.S. Constitution and throwing it at him every time he would try that. And I would say, find the provision and I will file the motion. And of course he couldn't. And so it was just mayhem.
Well, now Alvin testified in his own defense.
That was not my plan.
Well, I was going to say, I thought he got some instructions from on high about that.
Absolutely. Well, I did hire, this is a cautionary tale for young lawyers. This book is. The most excited Alvin got about the case was when I was showing him how to look on 1998 internet, And I found this wonderful epilepsy doctor whose name was in the all the abstracts about sudden death and epilepsy. Now, this was before you could cut and paste URLs. So I had to handwrite the URL out with all of its backslashes and then try to type it back just right to find that site again. But I found this really cool early internet site for this pathologist in Georgia. And I thought, well, I could use a pathologist to kind of help me. I already had my theory. She died of epilepsy. I already had Flojo's autopsy. All I needed was somebody just to give voice to what we had already kind of figured out. Well, I didn't really vet this guy. And the district attorney, Buzz Franklin, just destroyed him on the stand. It was total humiliation. And I felt so guilty because it was really all on me. But the guy wasn't even licensed to do what I was trying to get him to testify that he was an expert in. And so we were at a real low. But I had done well enough against the state pathologist that my friend Renzo Wiggins, who practices law next door, he was taking notes because he had a case with that pathologist in it. And he said, you know, he offered me his notes and he said, I got to tell you, I think you've got this thing as long as you keep Alvin off the stand. And I said, don't worry. That is the plan. So this disaster of my forensic pathologist happens and I'm really low. I'm thinking I've botched this thing. Let's go to lunch. Salesman Sam was around. Alvin's starting to have a little following from a new church. Alvin went to several churches until he would drain them of their goodwill, and then he would move on to another church. And so I just said, you know, you guys sit. I'll get your bill. Just sit alone. I'm going to sit alone this today. Well, that was the lunch I missed Jesus showing up to and telling Alvin sternly, you have to testify. And so Alvin tells me that on the way back to the courthouse. And I get the judge to give us a few more minutes. And by the way, I went into Alvin's house finally because my parents sent a turkey plate on Thanksgiving. And that Alvin is very transactional, as it turns out, later to be explained. When he let me in his house, I found all of these writings that he was kind of making a shrine of, but his wife constantly wrote. I only found out the night before I put my epilepsy expert on the stand that this is a condition called hypergraphia that often accompanies temporal lobe epilepsy, where it doesn't affect what is written, but it compels them to write. Virginia was a happy person. She watched a lot of television. She pitched a script to the Unsolved Mysteries TV show about Alvin's dad's car wreck, which which all the counterclaims resulted in the taking of Alvin's van. Well, Alvin was pretty smart, and he got the van returned, showing that they had prematurely got a writ of possession of it. So they brought Alvin's van back, but he would not accept it. He would not refuse it. He says that that'll start a new statute of limitations. And if I don't accept it, then I've got all the time in the world. That van has sat untouched now for 40 years. It's Gosh. Got trees growing up on either side of it. So, you know, the hypergraphia, that was a huge explanation of why this woman wrote so much. She had a kind of a fangirl obsession with the actor, director, and producer Ron Howard. She wrote a lot about him, and okay. I introduced some of it at trial. So I figured the jury would say, well, here's a woman who, you know, it really enjoys popular culture. She talked about music. She wrote songs. She was extremely religious, Old Testament kind of, I'm married now, my husband and I are one, that kind of thing. So, and I quite frankly think she was the leader of the two.
So I want you to tell us how you dealt with your advice versus the advice of our Lord and Savior regarding whether Alvin should take five and stay off the stand or get on the stand.
Well, I knew that it was Alvin's call. You know, it's always our client's call whether to testify or not. And as much as we can pull lawyers' right to choose, we can't on that. And but I tried to show him we had to change courtrooms mid-trial because with Virginia's writings in two old suitcases, because Alvin wouldn't trust me with them, Alvin brought scores of cockroaches every day into the courtroom. And it got so bad, the jurors saw it. The jurors talk about it on Forensic Files episode. So they moved us to the large old courtroom. Well, that was the last place Virginia Ridley had ever been seen, September 15, 1970. I'm not a ghost person, but that was eerie as hell. I felt a chill being in there with her writings, the last place she had ever been seen in public. At 27 years before. So, you know, Alvin had the right to testify, and I coached him a little, and I told him how it could go wrong if he put his good character into evidence. And what I didn't expect was Alvin was incredible as a witness. He really, as Jack Warner from the AJC put it, this man has been trying to get to that witness stand for 30 years. And I let him just let it all out. Daddy's car wreck, the civil litigation, they took my van, all of that stuff just got the greatest hits, as I call them, got in. And then, but Alvin was doing so well, I would forget how literal he was. And so I'd step in it every now and then. I'd say, Alvin, tell the jury what you lost. And I wanted him to say, the love of my life, my best friend. And Alvin said, oh, I guess the funeral bill. And the DA, of course, had a field day with that. Yeah. And I was thinking, can I not remember how literal this guy is? Well, we won the trial. And The Forensic Files and the American Justice and the People magazine, they came, and Alvin was cooperative in telling the story, but I could never explain Alvin. And just, he's eccentric. That's all we could come up with. So over the years, you know, I would try my fits and starts of writing about him, and then I just would be dissatisfied because how do you just say the guy's weird? How do you say that in a book? Well, one of the jurors in the case went on to be a nurse in Alaska, and a podcaster from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. We were participating in the podcast because Alvin likes chicken livers, and we were going to go eat chicken livers before we went to the podcast. And my secretary of the last 15 years, she used to work with developmentally disabled adults. So she was a natural with Alvin, and we just kept helping him as he aged. We got him to his appointments. We just kind of looked after him. And this juror contacts me through the podcaster and said, I think Alvin has autism. And it was just like throwing a cold bucket of water in my face because 27 years ago, nobody was talking about autism in adults. They were talking about with the spectrum was just being discussed. They were all talking about children, and they were all looking for a cause of it. And in fact, we've had autism since there's been mankind. And some of our greatest contributors have been, you know, on the spectrum, Asperger's, what have you. some of our greatest artists, greatest scientists. Alvin was a hell of a TV repairman when he was doing it, but the technology changed from picture tubes to solid state circuitry. And I think that's what ultimately did Alvin's business in. And he'll even admit that today, that people just throw away their TV sets and they don't need a TV repairman anymore. But that autism component, I took Alvin to Atlanta, paid for a doctor to evaluate him. She found him very much on the autism spectrum. And that formed the book in my head. Because there's 5.5 million adults like Alvin who have not been diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee in their interactions with an inpatient officer or a tired inpatient judge, they're going to get the brunt of that interaction. You know, sometimes and all through his trial, his autistic mannerisms were being used against him at trial. That doesn't sound like a man who just lost his wife, that flat vocal effect. His emotions were not where the neurotypical officer thought they should meet the moment. And I learned dealing with Alvin that he could be very emotional. He seems to absorb the emotions in a room, and then at some point he'll let them out. And
he cried on the stand when he was testifying on his own behalf. And I've got the book, and there's a picture of Alvin on the stand with his neck brace on, crying. And
classic.
I think some jurors thought that was it. That convinced them that he really did love Virginia.
You know what? Alvin himself very coldly will say, I think it was my real tears that swayed that jury.
So Ken, were you court appointed on this case?
I was not. I took Alvin over to get court appointed because he and I had developed a working relationship, and that was before the public defender's system. And the judge met us at the door and said, oh, Mr. Ridley owns too much property up in Chattanooga near the lake. And I looked at him and he said, Mama didn't ever want me selling that. So Alvin's got assets. He lives like a impoverished man because that's the way he wants to live. I'll buy him clothes. My secretary and I buy him clothes for our benefit, because at some point we don't want to be around the clothes that he's been wearing for a month. And, you know, it used to bother me how Alvin appeared and smelled. But after that trial, it's never bothered me since. He's a good, good man deep down. He just, as my dad said, he just thinks different.
You won the trial. You got an acquittal. Which I think a lot of people didn't see coming, except maybe you. So we know you saved Alvin. How did tell us about the aftermath of the trial for you personally? How did it play a role in your career at that point?
Well, I'd been messing around in politics for a decade, and Alvin's trial gave me a second act. Within 2 years, I was representing Ray Brent Marsh at the Tri-State Crematory in Walker County, which was a very fascinating, complex case that involved, the civil side involved class action law, which I had never done.
Hundreds of claimants, yeah.
Yeah, and the criminal side was, when you charge somebody with 847 felony counts, to where their sentence could be 8,000 plus years. I started saying four times the amount of time since Jesus walked the earth is a tad excessive a sentence.
Well, and just for our listeners who may not know that was the crematorium where instead of cremating the bodies. They were left in the Catoosa County woods.
Walker County.
Walker County woods. I later heard, Ken, that the civil case settled for, I was not involved in it, but something that they had to determine the value of a body laying in the woods in Catoosa County, and it was come up to be $100,000 was what it was.
Well, let me tell you that the way that the reason that I think the case settled with 12 years of prison time as opposed to 8,000 years was I challenged the theory of how do you distinguish with a dead body it being a felony or a misdemeanor. The only thing he charged was a misdemeanor amount in terms of the money that he got for each body was well below the threshold at that time, which was 500 at the time. I think it's 1500 now. But the issue then was, well, the stealing of the body. Well, how do you determine that? There is an old case over 100 years old that gives a quasi tort right for value of a body without naming a value, because as it said, it's not like a commodity like pig iron or something, but it is something of diminishing value.
Some
it's
are worth more value dead than all. Others, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it was the Supreme Court taking up those questions that got the sides to the table to settle the matter, because they certified my questions.
Not long after that, we had a wrongful death medical malpractice case in Bartow County. And to the shock of many, the jury returned a verdict against a physician, which had been unheard of before in this wrongful death case. And there was a verdict of $45,000. And I thought if the $100,000 was true, you're actually monetarily worth more already dead laying in the Catoosa County woods than you are being treated in a healthcare facility in Bartow County that leads to your death. You know,
there was a breakdown of the classes in the civil suit, and you'd have to ask Frank Jenkins to give you a better breakdown of because he was on our side along with Stuart James up in Chattanooga on the civil side, but there were some clients that were not insured. So I kind of stuck around to help them. Georgia Farm Bureau was the agency for the home that was on the property. There were all kinds of exclusions against businesses, but they endeavored to start defending the cases without getting a waiver of reservation of rights from my client. And so they were on the hook and not very happy about it. It was one of those moments. There was so much divine intervention in that case. Clara Marsh was a woman of faith. There was no evidence that any of the other family members knew about what was going on. Brent never, he took it all on his own. And as a matter of fact, the Walker County Sheriff had toured the place on the tip that there were dead bodies there and walked all around it in November of 2001 before the February 2002 discoveries. So, well,
and the motivation for it was that the furnace broke, wasn't it?
Well, I had Brent tested and his body was racked with apparent mercury poisoning. In Europe, you cannot cremate a body that has mercury amalgam in its teeth. And so you have to pull the teeth before you can cremate the body. And that's not the rule here. And this was an unregulated crematory because we in the legislature, and I voted for it too, grandfathered them in. Excluded them from being regulated. So it was it was one local legislation that Mike Snow introduced. And I just out of courtesy, I voted with it as well. But we could get that vote back and change that, and they could have regulated that crematory. Possibly none of this would happen because the stovepipe was compromised. And whenever they did burn something in there, it filled the room and was breathed in by the two men that were there. And Mr. Marsh Sr. died during my representation of the whole family of multiple organ failure that also implicated mercury poisoning as well.
Robin, you see what all you've missed by practicing law in downtown Atlanta instead of rural Northwest Georgia, you know?
Yeah, these are great stories. But McCracken, would you say that the Alvin Ridley trial and your great success in reaching an acquittal, and then you go on to the Marsh case, did it jumpstart your practice again being in politics?
Alvin gave me a second act. And you know, I realized that, you know, these cases kind of help you get more cases.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I was very inspired by the Marsh case because it was the nicest group of people I have ever represented, and really the nicest groups of people I've ever known, not just represent.
So they were not the difficult client as opposed to Alvin.
Absolutely not. The nicest people. But sadly, now I've represented some pretty despicable people. You know, I've given them their right to a lawyer, and I've never had, I mean, people who have done some horrible things. I've never had a bank cancel their mother's bank account because of what they did. But one of the local banks sent Clara Marsh a check and said, "We don't want your business anymore." And that so unnerved me that anytime I can call out Cahutta Bank for doing that, I will do it. And because it made no sense to me unless they were getting caught up in some of the racial overtones that they cowardly felt that somehow it was going to affect their bottom line somehow, that they would lose customers for mm-hmm. being the bank of choice of Clara Marsh, who was a very renowned former teacher. As Clara laughs and puts it, every time Walker County needs a federal dollar, they'll put me on a board. But, you know, because we lack such diversity up in the corner that she was hey, we need to get Clara on this board. That shows some diversity. And so
I was trying to remember, wasn't there a sword cane brought to court?
Oh my gosh. I would have been the first lawyer since the 1700s to get run through. A woman who was very passionate about the case tried to smuggle a sword into the courtroom, suddenly hobbling on a cane one day, and the wonderful Walker County Sheriff's security team smelled it out. I think one of them had seen such a cane before, and I would have probably been a shish kebab with my client.
Wow. Amazing. McCracken, I wanted to ask you, the photographs in the book are fantastic also. We talked a little bit about those. Were they taken just because the case was getting press coverage at that time? Because I've never seen that many trial photos.
Well, there was a Rule 22, you know, introduced for the trial photos. And so there were a lot of trial photos that had pool coverage as well. Gotcha. The court denied court TV, stating, because we don't know how Mr. Ridley will act. and that was, of course, in the paper. I accepted it because I was on such a losing streak, I didn't want to bring it to a national level.
Howard Finster, famous folk artist, even did a painting of Alvin This is amazing to me,
McCracken. I wanted that to be you. You obviously got the online version because you got the color version.
The color photos, they're gorgeous, but I cannot believe a Fenster painting of Alvin Ridley. That blows my mind.
Howard Fenster loved this case.
Amazing.
And he was, you know, relative neighbor to all of us in Northwest Georgia, and we were very proud of him. But I always thought, there's my book cover. Well, it shows you how little I know about publishing, because the publisher said, look, we're not going to tell you how to write your book, but you're not going to tell us how to sell one, and that cover will not sell. But it was going to be a cool cover, I thought, which is all I was worried about.
Do you know where this painting hangs now?
In my closet.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that.
It's funny that even though you own a Howard Fenster, before you publish it, you have to go to the Artist Rights Society in New York and pay for the right to publish it. And Howard's family remembered that he had given it to me, and they were very kind, and they, you know, it was nominal amount. But I just thought Howard was inspired by Alvin's story. Others are inspired. And now, you know, I suddenly, with Alvin's diagnosis, I had a call to action, because there are going to be, and right now I have a case of a young autistic man who there was misinterpretation, and the usual outcome is obstruction of an officer because they're yelling at you, sometimes using slang. And the person with autism, it's a processing issue. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking, what does that mean, reach for the sky? Or what does that mean, you know, whatever slang they're using? They don't understand it. They're processing it. And we don't understand the processing of those mannerisms. The neurotypicals don't understand the processing of what they're seeing. So I think it's an even problem of interpretation of each other.
I think
that was our conflict.
Well, that's a great point, that in any interaction with a autistic person or someone on the spectrum in an interaction with police officer, unfortunately, it may end up in death of Absolutely. The person who's on the spectrum, because they don't understand. And there's probably not enough training of the police officers with regard to that. So it is very timely.
And it's not always apparent. You know, sometimes you just get this blank stare back. Alvin and I were doing a book signing in Chattanooga last weekend. And he wanted a hamburger before we went. So I took him to a restaurant, and people around us started, they recognized him because I've been promoting this thing forever. And we ended up taking three people from three tables from Red Robin to the signing. But the server said, well, sir, you know, what do you think about, you know, doing a book signing and signing these books? And Alvin just deadpanned, I'm very excited. And that's how Alvin presents. But, you know, deep down, he's was very excited, but he's just not going to show it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I just love the book. I think you did such a great job. And I know I'm a trial lawyer, so that makes it even more relevant to me, but I really think anyone will enjoy this really riveting story.
I want to say something about the town of Ringgold in Catoosa County.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is a bad guy in this book. The prosecutor's doing his job based on what the coroner and the crime lab pathologists were saying. The coroner was brand new. She unfortunately had a run-in with Alvin, which made her frightened of him in the past. Everybody was acting on their best behavior. Nobody was trying to be mean or cause Alvin problems. That's what the cautionary tale is. We all think we're doing the job that we were hired to do or elected to do. But applying the rules of engagement, we often make a bad call. But since Alvin's autism diagnosis, which he allowed me to talk about online, he said, hey, maybe I can get more disability. And, you know, he was all excited about that. But the town, the warmth now coming from our community toward Alvin Ridley, mm-hmm. where he was, people were horrified of him. He was the boogeyman 27 years ago. And now they go up and speak to him, and they understand when they get that blank stare back that, and of course, he's a lot less menacing at 82 than he was in his 50s. So I feel honored and blessed to have represented him, mm-hmm. and still honored to have him around and help him navigate the world. My secretary feels the same way, and so we feel very fortunate.
And at the same time, you've helped him reach a level of notoriety, but also just general acceptance in his own community, which he may not be able to express that, but I'm sure he is so appreciative and loves it.
Well, he says he hopes to get two girlfriends, but he watches this cheesy TV show called Cheaters, and he's obsessed that if he has two girlfriends, they're going to roll up on him and expose him on the TV show Cheaters.
Oh my gosh. So, that's funny.
Probably he also said that the
probably
guy
also linked back to that van and the pancreatic cancer at some point.
Oh yeah. And Alvin, he speaks in absolutes, and he's talking about the host of Cheaters who wears glasses. And he says, you know, it's against federal law to hit a man with glasses. And I just accept it's Alvin's law, you know, I just accept it as what it is. But he used to spout those laws to me all the time.
That's great.
Have you thought what your next book is going to be?
My publisher is wanting me to think about it, but my agent said, just enjoy this time right now. And I'm quite actively, you know, thanks to y'all and other podcasts, I'm going to be on Good Day Atlanta on Monday. Whoever took over Larry King's nighttime radio show, I'm going to be on it on April 1st. And so, and then I'm going to Seattle to a crime writing festival with other writers from my publisher. And I love going to places where people show up to talk about murder cases, because you don't run as many people away as you do if cold call.
Absolutely. Well, you know, McCracken, our last question to every guest on our podcast is, how do you define justice? And we asked you to be thinking about that. What does it mean to you? How do you define justice?
Well, I always thought justice meant a fair disposition. And I worry that people have perverted the word justice to mean revenge. The show American Justice, our episode got elected on the internet for a period of time, the favorite episode. And yet there were people saying, but he was acquitted. Oh. In other words, how can that be justice? Well, if she wasn't murdered, then definitely that's justice.
Definitely.
So,
justice even when there's no crime committed.
Yeah, exactly. So there's the semantics of the word justice. It bothers me, and as many other icons of our country and our system have been somewhat twisted these days.
We usually make that the last question, but I'm going to give a subpart A to you here, Ken. And I want to know, did your definition of justice change after the Alvin Ridley trial?
Well, I felt justice was done there. I had a case in Murray County just a month ago, and we had an out-of-town judge come up, and I went through like three judges getting ready for trial, picking a jury, and then this new judge shows up for the trial. My client shot her boyfriend's testicle off.
Ooh.
And
allegedly.
I was trying to get in battered person syndrome. And the state of the law is now that you can only use that defense if the victim dies. I think that is an equal protection case ready to happen. But so I couldn't, the judge wouldn't let me use that charge to the jury, but he did let my expert get on the stand and talk about it. And I realized that I felt like the judge really felt that she was a battered person. So I shifted gears mid-trial to make it effectively a bench trial. I was making the jurors, the witnesses, look at the judge. And sure enough, the jury convicted my client. And the DA got up and said, well, she's not the first time she's waved a gun around. Judge, we want her 20 years to the door. Well, I had been trying to get her out of jail for over a year. They would not give her a bond in Murray County, Georgia. And so the judge asked, did you try to get her out on bond? I said, four times. And the judge issued a sentence of 20 years, served 394 days. And that's exactly the number of days she had served.
I'm served.
That's justice.
That's justice.
That sounds that's pretty justice. Good.
It's been great, Ken.
Yeah, it's Thank been you. Great having Thank you. You. Thank you so much. And I just want to remind our listeners that we've been talking with McCracken Poston Jr. and his book, and I'll hold it up for our YouTube viewers. This will also be on YouTube, Ken. But his book is Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom. You can get it on Amazon.com for your Kindle and hardback, and you can easily purchase it at McCracken's website, which is McCracken Poston Jr.
Oh, no, you can't. I guess I may have a link there. I think
you do have a link to yeah. It may be to Amazon, but you have a link.
Yeah.
So go out and just enjoy this wonderful book about a trial and a trial lawyer. And I just congratulate you again, Ken. It's just a fantastic book.
Thank you. It's a Georgia story. And it's got a lot of politics in it and a lot of law in it and a lot of characters that you'd think are unbelievable, but they really did exist. And some of them are still around. I go eat lunch with Alvin twice a week.
Well, I hope that much like Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil did for Savannah, that Ringo will now have its Zenith Man tours and be a tourist hotspot because
we're ready. We're ready. We've already got a few folks that have trickled in that have seen it on Forensic Files and just wanted to know where things were. And in the coffee shop that used to be Alvin Ridley's Zenith TV shop, there is a shrine to Virginia of her writings. Now there's some of her writings are framed on the wall in the coffee shop in Ringgold, as well as the People magazine article, the Washington Post article, and the times since, I guess, the first time since Dolly Parton got married in Ringgold that we've been on the news.
That's very nice.
Right.
Thank you both for having me.
Thank you. So now is the time when Lester and I like to share a little news article, law related, that's in the news. And I'll go first, if that's okay, Lester.
Absolutely.
My news article, law related news article, is here's the headline: an Oklahoma judge who sent more than 500 texts during a murder trial resigns. And Lester's probably familiar with this because many of our listeners know Lester represents a lot of judges in his practice. So he probably has seen just about everything a judge can do.
I had some people send me that.
I bet you did. This is an Oklahoma judge And she had been accused of gross neglect of duty, oppression in office, lack of proper temperament, and failure to supervise her office. And it turned out that during a murder trial in the killing of a two-year-old boy, they found that she was on her cell phone texting during the entire trial, had texted over 500 times. She mocked prosecutors, laughed at the bailiff's comment about a prosecutor's genitals, praised the defense attorney, and called the prosecutor's key witness a liar in all of her texts. She texted things like, the prosecutor was sweating through his coat. She described the defense attorney as awesome and asked, can I clap for her? So just showing a lack of judicial, I guess I'd say a lack of judicial temperament, but not even paying much attention to the trial if you're texting 500 times. And they brought her up on charges on the judicial commission there in Oklahoma. And they resolved it by her resignation, which I think is probably appropriate.
Yeah, that's sort of problematic if you're not watching the trial well enough. Right. Very, very interesting. So my piece is really one that came out yesterday. It comes from the New York Times, March 14th, 2024. With the headline, James Crumbly found guilty in Michigan school shooting trial. And as you know, there was a school shooting in Michigan with a young man who was obviously very disturbed. He not only was he charged, but his parents have been charged. And his parents were charged with both ignoring his they were charged with involuntary manslaughter or the equivalent of that, involuntary manslaughter. And they were charged because of the mother more not being attentive to the psychological needs of the son, but the father with buying a Sig Sauer pistol for him, knowing that he had all these problems. And it reads, a jury found James Crumbly guilty of involuntary manslaughter late Thursday over his failure to prevent his teenage son from killing four fellow students and wounding seven others in Michigan's deadly shooting. Mr. Crumbly and his wife, Jennifer Crumbly, who was found guilty on identical charges in a separate trial last month, are the first parents in the country to be directly charged for the deaths caused by their child in a mass shooting. And I think it's a significant extension of the law. But I think when you look at what the facts are of this case, you know, we've all heard the axiom that lawyers talk about hard cases sometimes make bad law, you know, meaning that when the facts are particularly egregious, it pushes us into a new area of the law or whatever. And that's certainly what has happened here. And I think the interesting thing to me is that, you know, we have a lot of differences in this country about guns. And it's interesting to me that in this case, you have people that I think, regardless of how you feel about firearms, you know, going and buying your disturbed student a Sig Sauer, you know, people realize that is beyond the pale. Having your child have a gun instead of getting mental health professionals to deal with him, that's also problematic. So I think it shines a light on what the criminal justice system is doing and is looking at in some of these mass shooting cases that unfortunately we seem to hear about every other day sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, I watched a little bit of that trial online here and there, and I thought maybe the jury was going to acquit him. They were out for a good long time. But the thing that got me, the one piece of evidence that really hit home with me about the dad's state of mind was when the parents get a text or some kind of alert that there's an active shooter in their kid's school, All the parents drove to the school to check on their kid, except Mr. Crumbly, and he drove to his home to see if the gun was still there. So that tells you he knew his son had taken that gun to school.
Well, and you know, if you go back to what you and I learned in law school, you know, foreseeability, being able to foresee that something bad is going to happen, is frequently sort of the watchword in both civil and criminal cases. When you're talking about some wrong taking place, you know, did you really think that this wasn't going to happen when you did, you know, whatever. And so I think that's, you know, if we strung together, as we frequently have, all our guests who have told us their view of justice, if you had a real complex view of that, being able to foresee, you know, when everybody is able to foresee that something bad's going to happen and do nothing to stop it, but also do something to facilitate it, I think it's a problem. But interesting case, interesting extension of the law. Really yeah. Loved our guest today. Of course, I've known him for well over 40 years now. I have not read the whole book yet, but I can't wait to get started on it.
I read the whole thing, and you mentioned Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. The characters are like another mm-hmm. episode of that. They're very much like that, except it happens up in Ringgold, Georgia, you know, North Georgia. Yep. But it's I love it. It does remind me of To Kill a Mockingbird too. I love the court. It's mainly all occurs in the courtroom, and I love that. So, really great book, and I urge our listeners to read it because it's fantastic. Well, we want to thank our sponsor, the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation. You can learn more about the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation at cuincourtpodcast.org. We thank our producer, Philip Hoover, and we thank our listeners. You can learn more about our host, Lester Tate, at aikentate.com, and you can learn more about me, Robin Fraser Clark, at gatriallawyers.net. You may listen to all of our episodes of the podcast at cuincourtpodcast.org. And we're also on YouTube now, so you can watch us do the interview if you would like to do that. And you can get this podcast anywhere where you get your podcasts. So great episode, and we'll be looking forward to our next great guest. And until then, Lester,
we'll see you in court.
See you in court.
You've been listening to the See You in Court podcast, brought to you by the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation. Remember, justice is a shared journey, and your engagement makes all the difference. For further insight and resources, visit our website at www.cuincourtpodcast.org. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at See You in Court Podcast for additional content. And don't forget to engage with our community on facebook.com/CUincourtPodcast. Special thanks to our producer, Philip Hoover. I'm Fred Smith, Executive Director of the Georgia Civil Justice Foundation. You may learn more about the foundation at www.fairplay.org. Until next time, we'll see you in court.